Get a concise daily market update from Charles Schwab, including the latest on U.S. and global economic news, stock updates, monetary policy decisions, and key results and statistics that may impact your trading. Schwab Market Update, an original podcast from Charles Schwab, provides an information-packed daily market recap in 10 minutes or less. Listen today at schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast or wherever you get your podcasts.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene, along with Jonathan Farrow and Lisa Abramowitz. Join us each day for insight from the best in economics, geopolitics, finance, and investment. Subscribe to Bloomberg Surveillance on Demand on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere you get your podcasts. And always on Bloomberg.com, the Bloomberg Terminal, and the Bloomberg Business App.
Debt limit talks stalling. Greg Peters of PGIM Fixed Income saying investors are paying for default protection in the near term. We went out the curve somewhat, as our sneaking suspicion is that it will continue year after year. The congressional disruption in D.C. is not going away anytime soon. TK, is this the old normal, the new normal? What do you want to call it?
I'm so glad you picked this paragraph from his research. No, John, this is the fixed income note I've seen in 10 days, maybe 2 weeks. Greg Peters at PGIM right now on where we are and where we're moving forward, joining us. Greg, it's a really complex thing. I think we need to talk for an hour with you this morning. But I want you to set up what the market reaction is going to be if we get PGIM persistency and yield, or dare I say we go to a higher 5.6, 5.8, and then the dreaded 6% yield. What happens when we get there?
Well, I think we're a long way to 6%. But at the end of the day, we do think yields are too low. If you look at the move that we've seen, particularly in the front end around the banking crisis of March, there was a really, steep move lower, and that doesn't make a lot of sense to us. And so, when we're looking at the curve, we feel like it's mispriced. We feel like it's already pricing in a recession. And then when you look at risk reward, even if you do get a recession, which is still, probable, of course, Will you be rewarded for it? And the question on the table, I think, suggests no.
Let's go pro here. There's a thing, Greg, called credit default swaps. Bramo talks about this all the time. You say there's a real efficacy to follow the CDS market. For mere mortals listening and watching, explain the linkage of their yield world with the CDS world.
Well, it just is a measure of credit risk of the U.S. sovereign, right? And so, what we've seen over the past couple months or so is that that risk is elevated, of course, right? So this debt ceiling debate, let's call it, is creeping into the risk of the market. You're seeing that in the CDS curves. And so what you've seen is investors really pay up for short-dated protection in the event of a default or some type of disruption. What we decided to do, and to be clear, this is very much of a drop in the ocean type of trade, but what we've decided to do is actually not pay up for, the couple months or even 1 year, because we do think it's a persistent problem. So, we really worry about it. I really worry about a PGIM that this political debate around spending and using the debt ceiling as a prop will be a common occurrence. And with that, we think it's good to have a little protection on.
So, Greg, can we go out further along the curve, away from the front end? Let's go all the way to the back end. What's the 30-year doing up near 4%?
Yeah, so the 30-year has different characteristics than the intermediate part of the curve and definitely the front end part of the curve. What you have in the back end is still very much, need for duration. Investors have to go out and hedge, or, pension funds and LDI accounts have to be out in the back end of the curve. So there's different characteristics there. So I think the informational content that comes out of the 30-year is a lot less kind of worthy than the intermediate and the front end. So for me, you know, I look at more at the intermediate part of the curve and more in the front end of the curve than I do the 30-year. But I mean, it's important, but it's not nearly as important from an informational content standpoint.
Greg, at a time when you do expect this turmoil to continue in Washington, do you consider corporate debt of very highly rated companies to essentially be more creditworthy right now than the U.S. government itself?
Oh, I think that's a tenuous argument. I've heard that argument. That doesn't make a lot of sense to me. That crops up, you know, every several years or so. You know, I really push back on that. So, you know, everything feeds off U.S. Treasuries, U.S. rates. So if the risk-free gets repriced, everything gets repriced off of it. So, you know, hiding out in high-quality credit seems like a fool's errand to me. You're not going to protect yourself in a way that you think you will be protected.
Do you think that people who are going into credit, in particular riskier credit right now, are also engaging in a fool's errand just simply because of the risk that you're seeing down the line of perhaps some of the defaults or at least the Washington turmoil continuing and this idea of some sort of recession getting priced in to the curve?
Well, if you're definitely going down in quality in credit, you are basically and essentially betting that there will be no recession, there will be a soft landing. And so I think that is, you know, also a kind of a difficult case to make. So to me, there's much more value being up in quality and not going deep down and, you know, deeper cyclical type of companies. So I don't know, you know, being down in quality doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I'm not sure you're getting paid for it either. I think it's too early. Very simple premise. I have yet to see credit spreads tighten into a recession. So if you have a high probability of a recession, you're you know, leaning against that narrative. So I don't know. To me, it's more of a high quality gain. Dispersion is super high, though. So there are lots of relative value opportunities. And we see a lot more value in structured products, as an example, than we do corporate credit.
Greg, can we try and make this really simple just to wrap things up? There were some headlines yesterday about a security that came to market with a yield of 6%. And it has one of those at-risk maturities early next month. Greg, can you explain to people what is the actual risk there? What is the risk there with that security? Because ultimately, surely, doesn't it get paid?
Well, hopefully it gets paid. This is the debate on the table, Jonathan. But the question for an investor is, like, why would you actually target yourself for that particular maturity? So, you know, if you do the math around it, you know, it's a much higher yield divided by 365, you know, times 10 days. Is it really worth the risk? So it's somewhat of an anomalous math equation. And so I wouldn't be so worried about the 6% because that's not really what you're going to earn. So, you know, from most investors' perspective, it's just not worth targeting yourself and getting thrown into the potential default pool.
Greg Peterson,
and hopefully that doesn't happen.
We all hope that doesn't happen. Greg Peterson, yeah. Peachin Fixed Income. Thank you, Greg. Appreciate it.
No one better in New York City to do this than Oliver Chen, senior equity research analyst at Cowen, who is just totally plugged into our aspirations as well. Mr. Arnault has done this 45 times at LVMH. John has mentioned this. John's really followed this story. He brings his sons over to an American icon, Tiffany. And is it right to say they blew it up?
Yeah, it's been tremendous in terms of the innovation there. And luxury is about magic and logic and bringing new, younger customers to the table as well. Tiffany is an iconic brand. The partnerships with Nike really elevating the assortment. And this flagship is one of the best stores in the world right now in terms of what they're doing. Experiential retail art, this unique experience. LVMH is definitely one of our top ideas. China's about 25% of revenue, so it's quite material. And we're really watching these near-term changes. The mRNA will be important.
You've coined a phrase that I love. It's stealth wealth. And if you know, you know. I could spot Brunello. I can spot the MS Orange poking out of your pocket right now. And then there are branding, the aspirational stuff. The people who line up outside the Gucci stores and they do the buy now, pay later. $50 a month, get whatever you want, get a hoodie. It's got a big brand in front of it. Lisa and I were talking about this before we came on air. We're trying to work out, has the latter started to crack? Have you noticed that at all? Because we used to see all these lines around these luxury stores. And when you used to speak to people in the store, the consumer was changing. They were moving away from dropping $5,000 on a handbag, and maybe they were thinking about it through a monthly payment. Has that started to fade, started to break in this country?
For sure, John. You bring up a great point. In terms of aspirational, more entry point luxury, logos as well as sunglasses and footwear could be gateways to luxury, and that's been softer. We've seen inventory levels that are too high at Nordstrom, Saks, Neiman Marcus for that reason. At the same time, when you think about stealth wealth, it's about materials, it's about touch and feel, it's about looking great at work too. That's been a trend that's been working too as the consumers become more cautious, and we've seen many shocks.
How much are we really parsing through the K-shaped recovery that we used to talk about that we seem to have forgotten, where basically people with the most spending power are spending it on luxury and able to do so in bulk, and you're seeing the others kind of fall off as the price increases really catch up more broadly in the economy?
We're definitely seeing a consumer discretionary recession in terms of those products and that market as a whole facing negative trends. We're also still seeing shifts where dollars are spent on travel and services, hotels. At the high end, that customer is very strong and robust. So we're still seeing strength at the high end. It's more that area right below the high end, the aspirational, where there's lots of pressure. At the high end, the wealthy consumer always has money. It's more about sentiment and emotions too. Certainly some of the financial shocks have been disturbing in terms of putting that customer on pause. Consumer confidence has been volatile as a whole, so it's definitely something we're watching.
The overlay here of China and what's going on there, is there a sense based on the luxury players that are more exposed to the Chinese consumer and less exposed of where that trend is? Is it falling off? Are people really seeing a shift there?
Well, structurally, long term, China is the biggest deal in luxury. It's 30% plus of the market, plus even more growth. So great luxury retailers, and Louis Vuitton's the largest market cap company in Europe. So it spends about $10 billion on advertising and promotion, and Tiffany renovation is well over $250 million just here in New York. China will be important for the long term, but it'll be fairly volatile as we watch these issues unfold. The name of the game in luxury is flagship stores, and stores that really make you forget about price. So being there physically is important, as well as a modern, upgraded, you know, rethinking the metaverse, a digital experience that's connected as well.
Are department stores then dead? If I'm at the corner of 57th and 5th Avenue and I'm looking from Tiffany's, waving over at Bergdorf, hi, what's the future of Bergdorf? And you mentioned Nordstrom earlier.
Oh, Bergdorf is very exciting. It's right there too in these magic corners.
Really? I didn't know that.
Bergdorf is an iconic institution. Oh, our recommendation is Macy's. Department stores are not dead, but they're transforming very rapidly and really needing to offer service, differentiated product. They really need to get the younger customer in, and that's been a constant, interesting, epic struggle. We're following Kohl's this morning. The gross margins were better than expected. Back to the basics for retail, as well as inventory management and supply chain, but I teach at Columbia. Don't forget, it's about magic and logic and really bringing things you didn't know existed that you wanted in retail, too.
He's the only one I know on the sell side that could conflate Kohl's and Tiffany in one conversation.
Throw in Macy's as well. Just quickly, what is it about Macy's that you like?
Inventory management, CFO really focused on it, an agile CEO, rethinking the loyalty program, using data. Artificial intelligence will play a huge role in personalization, the data sets, as we think about the future of retail. And Macy's has a loyal customer too. Needs a younger customer for sure.
We're not doing a giveaway on Succession because Farrell's got to watch season 3 and 4 top to bottom.
I've got one episode left.
What's a Succession for Arnaud at LVMH?
The family is doing a really modern job rethinking brands and captivating a younger customer, elevating brands. It's a company that manages for the very long term.
You didn't answer my question. There's like 3 sons, 2 daughters, the whole thing. What happens in season 3 of the LVMH story?
Well, I think it's going to be intensity, competition, and a real interesting battle for the best of the best. And that's what happens. You really need this competitive spirit to be culturally relevant. retail's awesome. Luxury's awesome because it's always changing. You got to be in touch with how music is moving, how TV is moving to be
God,
relevant.
I hope Mrs. Keenan's not watching this.
Love this. Oliver, this is great. Thank you. Oliver Chenna-Cowan. Such a stylish dude. Double-breasted suit. Pete LaPel.
He's like iconic.
Just absolutely awesome.
I'm going to just postulate that if he had a meeting at the White House, he would not be wearing
casual
shoes, hybrids. I'm just guessing.
No way. I've got a word on the hybrids.
I'm kind of in the churches. This is Brooks Brothers, so it's back to the basics, rethinking and double-breasted. Fashion's about old and new and bringing traditional mix and matching, but I'm also versatile. I'll do anything.
What do they call the understated thing? Like you on the weekends, the understated thing?
Stealth wealth. That's what Oliver was talking about.
Well,
yeah.
Materials, craftsmanship. Well, materials and heritage and how something is made and if it feels great, I mean, cashmere's here forever, yes, and stitching and craftsmanship. So you want
you
that against
churches.
Your skin, for sure.
Beautiful shoe, half brogue, churches.
British.
It is.
Nottingham.
There's a great tradition of that, so a little painful in the beginning, but it's worth it.
You break him in.
Yeah.
I agree.
I just would kill to get at a larger desk. Oliver Chen, Michael Burke, who ran Bergdorf's for years.
And Antoine Arnault.
And the great Vanessa Friedman of the New York Times.
Yeah, that would be
all
fun.
In together. Bring in Angela from London. He takes it so seriously. I mean,
as he should. It's his job, Tom.
It's a multi-billion dollar business.
What do you do if you put a sweatshirt in the dryer and shrink it?
You asked about this before. It really depends on the material. But I've done it a few times, and sometimes you want to shrink it. And sometimes you don't, but most of the time
it's
you
not
just,
the style.
You
don't
have you seen Lagerfeld?
Sometimes one wants to shrink it, and one doesn't
and
want to shrink
it. He reinvented, rethinking a real stature in the industry.
Yeah, okay.
I think we're done, aren't we? We are. Okay, good. Oliver, thank you.
Get a concise daily market update from Charles Schwab, including the latest on U.S. and global economic news, stock updates, monetary policy decisions, and key results and statistics that may impact your trading. Schwab Market Update is an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Join host Keith Lansford for this information-packed daily market recap, delivered in 10 minutes or less. Listen today at schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast or wherever you get your podcast. That's schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest-growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle-market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Two big stories here to talk to Jim Lucier about. Senior political analyst at Capital Alpha Partners barely describes the decades of experience. We've got the theater in Florida. We've got the theater in Washington. Jim, in your research note, which I thought was a really calming note, you talk about three subsets: the people that will bless this, the blessed, the people that will say the deal is acceptable, and I would suggest I'd add the furious as well. Who's going to win out here in the next 10 days among the blessed, the acceptable, and the furious to move on from this crisis?
I think the blessed and the acceptable are going to outnumber the furious. If you look at the way these negotiations proceeded, they've gone from hell no, we're not budging, to what kind of freeze do you want, to okay, who's going to deliver the votes for this? So I think that despite what you see on television about a standoff, they're actually fairly close.
James, I've got to turn to what's going to take place a little bit later on this afternoon. This talk on Twitter for Governor DeSantis, what do you make of this as a first step potentially towards a run for the big role in the White House?
Well, I think it's an unlikely match of personalities. The thing about Ron DeSantis is he's not exactly the most warm and fuzzy guy out there, even though he is a terrific administrator and terrific governor, terrific giver of press conferences. To have an unscripted moment with Elon Musk suggests that either he's prepared to roll the dice and try something very different, or else he just doesn't know what he's in for.
Do you think the first steps are important, or do you think in a couple of months' time we'll forget this?
I think that in a couple of months' time, we'll forget this. We have forgotten Elon Musk throwing the iron ball through the Tesla truck. We've already forgotten the stealth video in which President Biden announced his reelection campaign early in the morning, 2 or 3 weeks ago. I don't think the announcement makes that big a deal, but it is important as we go into Memorial Day that we start that one-year countdown to the presidential campaign beginning in earnest, which is really going to be next Memorial Day.
How interesting is it to you, James, that Twitter, a social media platform, is not so much tiptoeing as in, you know, screaming, running into the whole media kind of sphere in Elon Musk hosting this conversation? I mean, what is the distinction at this point between social media and media? And from a regulator standpoint, does this muddy the waters?
Well, Elon Musk likes to say that Twitter is the app for everything. And how do you better prove that you're the app for everything than by entertaining Tucker Carlson? So he's demonstrating you can do a lot of things on Twitter. I think Elon has a great commercial incentive to show that Twitter is a very effective platform, right up there with Amazon or Netflix. I'm not sure the regulators know how to do this yet. The regulators are fighting a retroactive war, I think, battling bigness, trying to fight bigness by breaking up and deterring large mergers. But I think Elon is far ahead of them at this point.
Well, and to that point, James, I mean, to John's point earlier, he was saying some are speculating that Twitter and Elon Musk is becoming the main competitor to Fox in sort of this alternative conservative universe, especially if you have Tucker Carlson launching his own Twitter space or Twitter platform. And you also have sort of initiation of Ron DeSantis' campaign all on the same site.
Well, you've got no shortage of people who've tried to launch alternative platforms. For instance, there's Glenn Beck. Megyn Kelly has her podcast. I guess O'Reilly is still out there. What's happening, though, is that as you see conservative media moving into this new video platform with Twitter, the old form, the AM media, the AM radio that was the home turf of Rush Limbaugh, that is slowly dying off. So, in other words, the old forest is dying and the forest animals are looking for a new environment.
Jim, you got such a study of history on this. I'm going to go back to the legit World War II hero, Robert Dole of Kansas. He'd be 100 here in July. Senator Dole ran for president, came out of Kansas in the Midwest, and really never related with the American public. Translate that over to the governor of Florida. How does he come out of Florida, where he won big, and translate over to a Republican and independent America?
Well, Bob Dole was a marvelously funny, warm, and empathetic guy. Everybody who knew him in person loved him. He was famous for cracking jokes nonstop in the Senate cloakroom. He was famous after he retired for sending donuts to the cloakroom every day. You know, the memory of Bob Dole is just incredible in that way. But he did have, I think, a bit of awkwardness with large audiences. DeSantis, though, nobody's ever really said that DeSantis is warm and fuzzy in that way. They're impressed with his smarts. They're impressed with his ability to lead as a former military officer. They're impressed with lots of things about him. But you don't hear people talking about DeSantis inspiring the deep personal loyalty among his constituents, among his base, among friends that Bob Dole certainly did. I knew Bob Dole. My father knew Bob Dole very well.
James, wonderful to get your perspective on things, particularly with that in mind. James Lucia there of Capital Alpha Partners.
What's great about Liz Young is she writes these brutally direct notes as head of investment strategy at SoFi. She loses the ratio mumbo-jumbo and talks about the mood and emotion that's out there. You're speaking of housing, Liz, but I think just talking to Oliver Chen of Cowen about the persistence of luxury, I'm going to steal a phrase from you. We're in a milieu of bulletproof demand. We just keep seeming to continue to prosper here amid all the gloom. How do you see that?
Well, I think there's a difference between the demand that we're still seeing from certain sets of consumers, and especially in the housing market, in the face of rising mortgage rates again, mortgage rates that are higher than they've been in 40 years. And there just continues to be this appetite to spend. I think when you look at what's happening signal-wise, both in the economy and in many parts of the market, this is pretty classic late cycle behavior. The challenging part for many investors, myself included, is that late cycle can last a very, very long time. It can last up to 18 months, maybe even longer. So we could continue to say it's clear that we're in late cycle. At some point, there's probably a contraction to bring us back into early cycle that would soften that demand. But could it be another 6 months? Perhaps. And I think that's the frustrating part in the meantime to try to make money in the market.
John, brain freeze, surveillance correction. Liz Young is with us, and I was thinking of the day I first heard Liz's story, the piano player, when she fell on the scene of singer-songwriter.
I don't know Liz's story.
Liz's story
was
spectacular.
Like? She's good?
Spectacular voicings.
Was she as good on the piano as Liz Young is
at market? Liz Young on piano is a sight to behold.
Grandma.
I don't
Excuse me,
piano.
Liz. I am so sorry.
Well, Liz, you said something I want to pick up on, this idea that late cycle can last a very long time. How do you know when you're getting to the end of a late cycle that can last for 18 months?
Well, it's difficult to know exactly what those signals are. I think if we all knew exactly what it was supposed to look like right before a recession came, we'd not have all of this consternation about what's happening. One of the things that I watch, and I continue to watch this every single day, is the yield curve inversion. Now, we know that the inversion itself, especially at the twos, tens, is more of a signal pre-recession or a warning sign of, hey, there could be some bumps ahead. We don't know when, we don't know how big. And then you hear that old adage of, you know, the yield curve has predicted 9 of the last 5 recessions or something. So it's not a foolproof indicator, but when that inversion starts to re-steepen, meaning the inversion becomes more shallow, that tends to be the time when your ears should perk up and you start to listen for indicators that the Fed may pause, the Fed may have to cut. And that's what we're looking at in the market right now. The market still believes that the Fed is going to have to cut before the end of the year. The Fed holding steady and saying that absolutely not, we are not talking about that yet. Also, their own projections of inflation are still above target, both at a core and a headline level, by the end of this year. So if things go the way that they expect, no cuts on the horizon in 2023, the market is sending a different signal saying, hey, we think that things could weaken. It's possible that we see cuts. So when you start to see those yield curve inversions get more shallow, you start to see the expectation that the Fed may have to pivot, may have to change policy at some point in the next 12 to 18 months. That's usually the time when you feel like the clock is really ticking on when we're going to find out whether or not this recession actually occurs.
Given that the music is still playing, do you play? Do you invest in stocks? I mean, are you basically in the Savita Subramanian camp and not on the Daryl Cronk camp of staying cautious amid an end cycle that could last for another year?
I'm cautious on the market, and I admit I did not see this rally in tech stocks coming this year. I mean, up 20 to 26%, depending on what part of the NASDAQ you're looking at, is pretty astonishing. But if you're a long-term investor, and this constantly is a theme that I think everybody should think about, if you're a long-term investor, you should be invested in stocks on some level at all times, because there's really no other place to generate capital growth in that way. However, if you're a long-term investor that doesn't have a stomach for volatility in the short term, you do have to position defensively in this environment, especially at a time when we've got yields back up again. I know that you talked about that earlier in the program. As yields rise again in this environment, valuations really do matter, and you're paying a lot for some of those names that have done really well so far in 2023. So if you're not somebody that has a ton of stomach for short-term volatility, and when I say short-term, I mean 6 months or less, then you have to have defensive positions in the portfolio. But if you're a long-term investor, let's say beyond 3 to 5 years, you do still have to have equities.
Hey, Liz, thank you. Liz Young there of SoFi.
Hey,
Get a concise daily market update from Charles Schwab, including the latest on U.S. and global economic news, stock updates, monetary policy decisions, and key results and statistics that may impact your trading. Schwab Market Update is an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Join host Keith Lansford for this information-packed daily market recap, delivered in 10 minutes or less. Listen today at schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast or wherever you get your podcast. That's schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest-growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle-market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing. The passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You know, we're going to dive right into this right away because it's like a three-hour conversation with Douglas Cass. He's at Seabreeze Partners, moving money around in Florida, and he's been very vocal. But Doug, I want to start with what I saw at Oak Hill, where I used to caddy, with just stunning memories of my ute. I went to dancing school there, Doug, with girls with white gloves on and, you know, the whole thing from another time and place. And there's a guy from California. You hit a 75 last week, Doug Cass. In my dreams, I could hit a 75. You're not too far from Michael Block. I mean, you're really working at it. What did you think of the miracle the PGA wrought last weekend?
I think that for those that have no idea what we're talking about, Michael Block was the PGA club pro who had a hole-in-one and finished tied for 15th in the PGA Championship last week. And I think he's the reason why we love sports. It's the unexpected which excites us, like my 75 you referenced on Saturday, or like Judge's home run to tie the game last night and Volpe's walk-off and the recovery of the Yankees in the last 3 weeks. It's why we root for AFC Richmond over West Ham, Tom.
Yeah, well, Richmond's doing well this year.
That's a Ted Lasso reference.
You know, but Doug, they're in the bunkers. And when I was at Oak Hill, the bunkers didn't look like that. It was like the Berlin Wall in front of you on the way to the green. And where does Michael Block's hands fall apart because he's never faced that pressure? Is it in the bunker? Is it hitting the ball the first time with the driver? Or is it on the putting green?
I don't know. It was the classic Caddyshack Cinderella story.
Yeah.
That's why we love the game.
Critty just sports. Woke up because you mentioned Caddyshack. And she's like, okay, would you like to ask a question to Doug Cass about the equity market?
I would love to. I finally recognize something.
Hi, Critty. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Lovely to have you on. Let's talk about this debt ceiling. What happens if we get, say, we avert a default? Do we get a relief rally, or is it just more gloom and doom? What happens next?
I think it's just a sideshow to the core problems facing the markets, Greedy. Look, we all make mistakes in this business, but one of the benefits of having experience in managing money over the last year and a half in particular, and having been around the block, is to quote Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young, we have all been here before. We were in 1999 during the dot-com mania. We were in late 2007 in the home price mania. And again in 2021 in the ARC disruptive stock mania. We are there again in May 2023. Today it's a speculation in AI. And in, as Mike Darda discussed really well in the last segment, the negative market ramifications of a top-heavy market in which leadership is historically narrow, which reminds us of 1974 when the Nifty 50 blew up, leading to 7 years of lean returns for stocks.
So it sounds like the AI rally that you're seeing, not sustainable in your view.
Correct. I think that the two circles we have to square, Kriti, are the soft landing and speculation in AI. The market's at nearly 20 times. It seems to be betting on a soft landing, though in reality, the market goes up and down, and oftentimes traders and investors simply chase in either direction for no real reason other than they are evaluated against the benchmark and care more about that than they do in making money or preserving capital. I think soft landings only tend to happen when the Fed has been proactive with monetary tightening. In this case, they've been badly behind the curve and badly reactive, so forcing a somewhat aggressive tightening cycle in the last 14 months, especially relative to the zero base we came from. So yeah. We have sticky inflation. It's mostly a function of labor costs. Soft landings don't tend to take labor out of the system and lower pressure on wages. Only hard landings do that. So how do we get sticky inflation out of the system without a hard landing that the market implicitly is betting against?
Right.
And then secondly, of course, we have the hot topic du jour, in which Tina has taken a new form. It's in AI this time, but AI has been around for years. And as I discussed in an article I just wrote for Real Money Pro, the pathway to AI adoption and profits is likely to be rockier than many expect.
And Kriti, this is so important what Mr. Cass is saying, and I go to the railroad model. Mm-hmm. The railroads went down in flames in the 1890s for all sorts of reasons. And then they finally got it together, the second act around.
Yeah.
Saying, you know, we've seen this with AI for years.
Yeah. Well, Doug, I was just reading your column, actually, and the case you make here is simply that the adoption is going to take much longer than what the market is pricing in. But what is the actual value to a lot of these big tech companies sitting on piles and piles of cash, record amounts of cash, that are all going into AI, Alphabet, Microsoft, et cetera? So is it really fair to say that some of these gains are unjustified?
I think it is, and Kriti, I'm not a Luddite. You know, I was on with Tom and Paul in late 2022 when I was buying all these stocks. I was buying them at under 4x sales, and now with the stocks up dramatically, there's no longer a value in my view.
Yeah, Doug. With time left here, and I there's just so much to talk about today. You have a Florida perspective like nobody I know. The governor of your state tonight, I guess, is going to launch a presidential campaign with Elon Musk. Now, you know Mr. Musk. You've been very supportive, I believe, of the space stuff and all that. And you know, you're hugely visible on Twitter. But this is your governor. What are you going to listen for from Governor DeSantis this afternoon tonight?
Well, let's begin by framing it. You're talking to a former Native Raider and a progressive liberal. Who believes in pro-choice and has a political view, and my political view is antithetical to DeSantis.
He won big in your Florida. Can he extend that across a comfortable Republican
America? I don't
think
he has a chance against Trump. I don't think he's a likable character. I actually think he's on the spectrum based upon my conversations with him. And I don't think he's going to be competitive against Trump. So I think it's an academic question. You know, I'm much more concerned about the markets.
Well, you know, let me bring this back to Kidder Peabody. I mean, Kriti doesn't know this, but long ago, your meat and potatoes, I think, are Mario Gabelli and auto parts and industrial stuff.
Right.
Cass on the high ground in banking. I looked at PacWest today, and they got a 13-month 5.50% CD dug out of our ute. I mean, are you going to load the boat on regional bankers in crisis?
No, you can't right now because of the aforementioned conversation you had in the prior segment. It simply stated the cost of capital, the cost of funds are going up dramatically. This combined with FDIC extra assessments and other factors are going to really weigh on the secular earnings growth rate of the industry over the next 2-3 years.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, the sell side has not yet reduced their estimates.
Doug, a final quick question in our last minute here. When it comes to the biggest concern after this debt saga,
sure.
Where does China rate on your list, the growth concerns that we're seeing there?
China is, as as we all know, is the driver of global economic growth, but that really is not my primary concern vis-a-vis the speculation I see. I'm not certain of much, but one thing I'm certain about is that the S&P is highly valued, especially against interest rates, and our reasonable and much lower than consensus forecast for profits. And I'll just briefly say that at yesterday's close, the Fed funds rate was 5.08%. The six-month Treasury yield was 5.4%, and that's roughly 3.5 times the S&P dividend yield of 1.65%.
Right.
It costs 7.1% for a fixed-rate mortgage,
right.
And the S&P basically closed where it did 15 months ago when the Fed funds rate was only 8 basis points. The yield on the six-month note was 1%, or roughly two-thirds the S&P dividend yield, and the fixed-rate mortgage rate was around 3%, and the S&P is basically the same price.
And also,
15 months ago, the consensus S&P estimate was $252 a share, and now it's close to $215 a share. So I don't see any value in the market.
I'm out of time. I wanted to get to Garrett Cole and the New York Yankees, but we're out of time. Doug Kass, thank you so much. It's Seabreeze. Subscribe to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live every weekday starting at 7 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can watch us live on Bloomberg Television and always on the Bloomberg Terminal. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Keene, and this is Bloomberg.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.